Hello everyone, welcome to the Local Shop Podcast. I'm Chris Noyce and this, as always, is the podcast for everything to do with the convenience sector and the issues facing local shops. We've got a huge episode of the podcast for you today. A really, really important interview with Matt Truman from True Global. Some of you may recognise from a presentation that got everybody talking at the Technology Showcase a couple of years ago. Matt is a retail and e-commerce investor, an incredible story. He tells a story of how he's got to where he is, but what he's really talking about with us is about the advent of online super fast, super quick delivery services like Getir, Wheezy, all those kind of things that have been making the headlines over the last weeks and months, and how convenience fits into that. So without further ado, let's not delay this any more than we need to. Let's get straight in and talk to Matt. Hi, Matt. Great to speak to you.
Hi, Chris. Nice to see you again.
Yep, and you. For lots of retailers that are members of ACS, lots of suppliers that are members of ACS, they will be familiar with you because of your fantastic presentation at the Tech Showcase a couple of years ago, which actually just feels like a couple of months ago, but we've had, had almost 2 years in the interim.
Yeah.
For those of the people listening that don't know your story, can you give us a bit of a background on how you came to be where you are with True Global?
Yeah. Look, firstly, thanks for having me. Nice to be back. So I started life as an accountant, then investment banking. I ran an American bank called JP Morgan's retail consumer team. And through a combination of the sort of investment banking and my own entrepreneurial activities, I saw what I believe was quite significant consumer behavioral change between the period of sort of 2004 and 2008. As part of my day job at the bank, I advised and ended up floating a load of sort of e-com 1.0 businesses. So my team floated AO.com, my team floated Ocado. We're long-term advisors to ASOS. We did a German marketplace in autos called Deltacom, and they were all consumer-facing. So in 2008, Paul, my co-founder at True, and I decided to build our own e-commerce business, which we built from three of us in a shed in Chelsea, despite none of us living in Chelsea. Still don't know to this day why we went to Chelsea, but and we built it.
Chelsea, aren't they?
Yeah, exactly. Well, Chelsea Harbour had these little sheds that didn't have any security, so it was the only thing we could afford. And we just didn't think anyone would want to steal our stock. So we went from three of us to 120 people in 3 years, selling 68 brands in 70 countries. And we ended up selling that to a company that's now become the largest investor and venture in the world, actually called Tiger Global in New York. And we sold that to them in 2011 and then seeded a number of other e-commerce businesses with that, with the proceeds from that. And some of them did really well. And we sort of learned from that. Now, the observation from my day job, which was advising Tesco, Metro in Germany and other big grocery businesses predominantly, but also floating some of the tech 1.0 companies, and then also building my own, was that I just felt the investment industry didn't have a very good answer when an entrepreneur, founder, or manager turned to them and said, you know, how can you help us? You know, how can you help accelerate and optimize my business? Now, there's some very bright people in the investment industry, but also culturally, I felt that, you know, private equity had a terrible name. You know, if you said the word private equity and retail consumer, someone immediately shouted Vulture and Debenhams at you pretty quickly.
Well, and we're seeing that right now with Morrison's, aren't we? I mean, happening.
And therefore, I just felt the industry had a huge opportunity. It's a huge industry. It's full of very bright people who fundamentally want to grow businesses in almost all cases that I've met. And therefore, they just had a bit of a challenge of how to articulate the value that they could add. But also, I just felt there was many more competencies that could be added to the platform that enabled us to be more helpful. So I quit the bank, never been in private equity, and decided to build what I believe was a sort of fit for the future investment business that had, you know, helping people at its heart, but also culturally trying to be very future orientated and understanding where the world goes. So that's manifested today in true. A lot of hard work, two guys in a bedroom in 2013 has manifested itself in sort of three buckets of businesses. The first is our own innovation, the technology lab, some of the things I came to talk to your audience about a few years ago. That lab has grown to see about 3,500 businesses now from last year, 43 countries. We have some fantastic partnerships in places like Tel Aviv, who are at the cutting edge of innovation and change. And that's sort of the flow of the innovation that we see. And the reason I set that up really was because I wanted the true team to understand the changes in the industry, the people, businesses, and ideas that were reshaping retail and consumer. You know, it's 35% of the world's companies. It's a huge, huge, huge market. I wanted to see that faster and more consistently than any of my competitors or peers. I thought it would make us more interesting people. And frankly, hopefully, you know, the logic is better investors because you can see the risks coming down the track in terms of the level of disruption. So I thought, well, if I want to see that, then surely the sort of largest in the world will want to see that as well. And so we started signing commercial partners to show them some of the technology with the hope that they would implement it and therefore they would get a return on it. We now have 20 corporate partners, so it's grown quite considerably since I last saw you, Chris. And we have people like Coca-Cola, Johnson & Johnson, Morrisons, Waitrose, John Lewis, Primark, TJX, who own TK Maxx out of Boston, the entire 7-Eleven convenience estate globally, Shell's retail division, so their convenience business, and Grosvenor Asset Management, Warner Brothers, Walgreens, the pharmacy chain in the US. You know, it's grown to a really sort of considerable program. And then the last bit of true is the investment business. And we sort of look at that ecosystem and deploy capital in two ways. The first is through a young innovation early stage fund. So Nick at Near Street, who presented at the same conference of ours, was a beneficiary of that early stage fund and is doing very well. We have about 30 million of assets in that fund. And we typically write checks of sort of anything from £50,000 to, you know, a few million. And then the second pot of capital is the private equity business, which is very focused on fit for the future, digital first businesses. And that has a pot of capital of about just a touch over £600 million now. So, and the idea with the business is we add value, therefore, in three ways. If you're an investment company of ours, so you sit in the middle of plugging in the most cutting edge technologies that have come through the lab that have also already been tested on some of our corporate partners. At the same point, you benefit from the board level relationships of those corporate partners to, you know, do co-marketing initiatives, strategic partnerships with whatever it is. And at the center, and it is at its core, it's about the quality of people and the synergies from their knowledge. So, you know, we own 12 direct to consumer e-commerce brands across the growth and the private equity fund. And there's tremendous synergies, learnings, best practices, collaboration that comes from that. And we're very deliberate about how we push those traditionally quite disparate siloed buckets together, basically.
Yeah.
And that creates just a really cool ecosystem of interesting people, to be honest. And it's then how you constantly top up that ecosystem and stay relevant. And the last thing I would add is culturally, I always wanted to lead a bit of change in the space. And, you know, last year, 90% of people we hired for true were from what I would call underprivileged backgrounds. Not something you would say necessarily in private equity normally. And, you know, we are 50% women and 45% ethnic minorities in terms of our team composition. And that's led to this tremendously valuable diversity of opinion around the table, really representing the sort of broader consumer rather than the consumer in Mayfair. So that's true, really. That's what we've built. And as I said, the group's now just under $1 billion of assets.
It's an incredible story of several times where you've had to basically back yourself and, you know, take those risks that, you know, on a smaller scale, I guess lots of retailers, lots of suppliers are taking as well. And, you know, that's ultimately what makes success in the sector, isn't it? So, you know, there's anyone better placed to talk about, you know, new technologies, new emerging markets in our sector than yourself.
Well, it's kind of you to say. I think, you know, I've met I met a number of your convenience store operating guys, and you know, they've done an amazing job, right, to build something. It's a fiercely competitive sector, grocery, always will be. You know, you're dealing with something highly emotional, people's nutrition and sustenance. You're dealing across every demographic. It's an incredibly complex business. But you know, I philosophically, I just believe life's quite short. So I think we all want to wake up in the morning and want to go to work and want to enjoy it, you know. And I think for me personally, everyone's different. For me personally, it's sort of having a go and trying to push the boundaries that interest me.
And over the last 18 months, how has the pandemic affected the investment business? Has it been as close to business as usual? Has there been more opportunity with other things dropping off? What's it been
like? Yeah, it's a very good question. So I would say at its core, we've been incredibly fortunate. You know, we own direct consumer internet businesses. So in March 20, when it became clear that the distribution centers would remain open in many categories, then, you know, you had a drop off from the bricks and mortar competition. And, you know, depending on the sector, bricks and mortar would be ending from sort of 50 to 90% of your competitive workforce, meaning, you know, you didn't have to discount, you didn't have to spend with the same level of marketing intensity as you did. So it was definitely favorable in that respect. On the flip side, we do own businesses. You know, we own a healthy foods platform, which is a global brands platform. And that business suffered because, you know, its headquarters are in Melbourne, Australia, and they took an incredibly aggressive view to lockdown. And therefore, you know, we have healthy food and drinks brands that typically would, you know, replace Coca-Cola, for example, and at a lunchtime office snack. And,
or the press conference.
Know, and no one was in the office, right? And still, and frankly, still isn't. So, you know, we've seen the challenges that many would have faced in that respect as well. And I'd say, you know, overall grocery has obviously been pretty resilient. I would say the industry has done a fantastic job, frankly, for the consumers. And I think many of them have behaved incredibly well towards just frankly looking after people, which is, you know, what it's about at the end of the day.
And that's a really good point to jump off on. And one of the things that lots of local stores have done for the first time over the last 18 months, and you mentioned looking after people, is having some form of delivery service. And we know that lots of retailers tell us that this is typically quite low tech. It's taking orders over the phone, writing them down. It's in some cases having a walk around the shop with a phone in your hand going, oh, we've got this, we've got that. Do you want this? You know, what the ingredients, this kind of thing. Obviously that's quite hard to sustain. So retailers are looking for more integrated solutions, more sustainable solutions.
Yeah.
And coming out of that, I think there's been an acceleration, especially in the last 6 months, of these ultra rapid delivery grocery services. To name a few, there's Getir, Wheezy, Deja, Fancy, Gorillas. I think if you could make up a word, you can probably build a business. Just as a sort of initial viewpoint, how much interest is there in the investment community in these types of businesses? Because there seems to be a new story in the FT every day with, you know, funding rounds going for these businesses and real interest in the community.
Yeah. So look, it's a really good question. And, you know, I think let's just step back for a second. And these sort of slightly cataclysmic changes in the industry always feel like they're incredibly high risk. Most executives immediately write them off in their mind. Most executives don't look at the underlying, you know, they look at the underlying economics, and very fairly they say things are never going to work. But I think if you step back from why this is attracting so much interest, you know, you've got a phase in the technological cycle where software is, you know, to coin sort of Mark Andreessen from Andreessen Horowitz's phrase, is sort of eating the world. And you're at quite an early stage of software penetrating this sector. If you think about, you know, stepping back, you know, compact discs becoming MP3s and then frankly just streams, you know, and that whole physical hardware has disappeared and just become software. Something as simple as your alarm clock is now just an app on your phone, when it used to take up the whole of your bedside table. And, you know, all of these things, and the producers of these products are transformed therefore from, you know, manufacturing, media, financial services to frankly software companies. And their core capability is sort of creating and running software. And Ocado is the sort of, in grocery terms, is sort of the pioneer of that, if you like, as you know, which it probably initially never set out to be. You know, it set out to be a more efficient logistics business, but is now fundamentally a software business. So the sort of step back, if you like, before we get into the detail, is the software redefines the product. And, you know, is assuming that the market isn't protected by monopolies, which is not grocery, albeit it is dominated by predominantly four or five businesses, the nature of that competition will change until the best software company, you know, the best software company wins. Now, therefore, the challenge for the grocery market is, you know, who do I partner with? I'm not going to out invest them on tech because I haven't got A, the capital, and B, I haven't got the people in my business to be able to do that. So the key question is partnerships, which is why you've seen, you know, if you take a Morrisons, you've seen them be very smart around partnering with Amazon and partnering with Ocado and giving themselves that optionality. And you're seeing, you know, Deliveroo now becoming commonplace, or Just Eat becoming commonplace, or Uber Eats becoming commonplace across all of those major chains, because they recognize that actually utilizing someone else's investment in tech is a more efficient allocation of capital than trying to build it themselves. So that brings you up to speed with, therefore, you know, what has emerged from that initial phase is, you know, is Q-commerce. So, you know, why is this interesting in purely philosophical terms for a moment? It's interesting because if you think about what Deliveroo can't do, is Deliveroo at the moment can't control availability. Mm-hmm. So for instance, I want two tubs of Ben & Jerry's delivered from the co-op 5 minutes up the road. If on a Saturday it's been hot, everyone wants Ben & Jerry's, there's no availability, Deliveroo fundamentally fails. And therefore, you know, the challenge for Deliveroo is you're just a middle piece of that infrastructure and in a relatively low margin part of that infrastructure. So what you've seen, therefore, is this is the natural evolution further up the supply chain into, well, how do I control the availability of product? And fundamentally, you know, I'll control the consumer relationship purely from a software perspective, which gives me all sorts of synergies versus the typically sort of human and capitally intensive way of the traditional supermarket. So that's the sort of philosophical way as to why it's got interesting. Then if you say, okay, well, venture, you know, venture tends to sort of be quite a volatile arena. It's this area has attracted huge amounts of investment. So if you look at grocery delivery startups in what I would call Q-commerce, you know, it was receiving about 1.5 billion of investment in 2015. That's grown to 3.3 billion of investment in 2020, from what we can see. Sure. But already halfway through 2021, it's grown to 4.1 billion pounds. So you've got the best part of $6 billion year to date, 19 billion in totality raised in the last 5.5 years. That's 19 billion pounds, so nearly, you know, $26-27 billion. But if you step back from their perspective, you look at global FMCG, and it's an $11.5 trillion market.
Sure.
So you can afford to get a bit overheated in some of the valuations. So, you know, GoPuff, as an example, in the US, you know, has raised 1.8 billion. They've entered the UK through acquisition of Fancy in 2020. You know, their valuation is just under $10 billion. Getir, you know, obviously at 5 billion, you know,
and this is what I find interesting, is that there's not, it doesn't seem to be one horse that people are backing yet. There's quite a spread of,
yeah,
and this is kind of the what I'm trying to get my head around, is that where do these business differentiate? Because they seem to all be very similar in terms of the model, like you said, getting control, yeah, over the supply chain, giving control over wholesale. If the product is the hero, how do these different, how do the apps differentiate from each, yeah, other?
Yeah. So the answer is they don't really. And this isn't new, right? So if you take Uber and Lyft, and then you know, they had a head start, they had a foot race, and it became about who's going to win, you know, which one does SoftBank back, which, you know, which one has the most capital to then just take share of voice as quickly as humanly possible. And you're seeing exactly the same here, right? I mean, in the UK, I mean, you read, and, you know, there'll be nuances around the edges, but you read out five or six names, all of which fundamentally deploy a highly localized dark store model that enables people to have their groceries fulfilled, albeit a small selection, fulfilled within, you know, if you look at, you know, a get here somewhere between 7 and 20 minutes, depending on the capital city or the densely populated city that they're in. So it's a bit of a race. So what you typically see, Chris, you see the venture universe sort of place bets, and then over time, they'll all spank a load of money on marketing, mostly venture capitalist money. And then over time, they'll consolidate as whoever's won that foot race will start to acquire, merge with the two or three players in the other capital cities that can't quite get the scale that these guys have. And therefore, the venture capital funding dries up for the people who are coming fifth, sixth, and seventh in London. They get consolidated up. And as you remove some of the competition, some of the marketing intensity comes out. And that enables them to at least get less loss-making. I was going to say profitable, but probably less loss-making.
Sure.
Now, why is this interesting? I mean, Amazon started this sort of hyper-localized view, right? Where I remember when Bezos said, we'll be able to get you stuff the next day. All the retailers at the time went, you know, A, impossible, and B, you know, it doesn't make any difference. Consumers don't want it. And you only have to look at Prime and the participation in Prime to see how that's successful. And I think philosophically, consumers will always want things faster, more conveniently, and cheaper. And that's never going to change. So faced with the prospect of, you know, habits were formed pre-pandemic that had lasted for generations, which is, I'm going to go to the high street on a Saturday morning and wander around, or I'm going to go and do my supermarket shopping on a Thursday evening and spend an hour and a half there. If someone then says to you, well, I can give you the same quality dark pit and I can send it in 9 minutes, then, you know, there's going to be a certain level of adoption.
Yeah.
Now the challenge is that there's some fundamental nuances with that, which is A, the marketing, everyone's throwing marketing at it, which means it's going to lose a lot of money. But secondly, you know, there is a limit to how much complexity you can pick in 8 to 20 minutes, you know, no matter how good the robotics are. You know, Ocado are miles ahead in the robotics automation space. And, you know, I suspect their picking wouldn't enable them to do that even in dark store environments. So, you know, you can get 8 to 10 products, but that's never going to fulfill the sort of overall one-stop shop grocery aspect. But what it is going to take is sort of this slight death by a thousand cuts of the convenience chains, you know, is going to impact those. But it's also going to impact them in high density cities where there's very high end demographics. You know, at the moment, this is the preserve of the wealthy. You know, this is, yeah, by, you know, I've already had 5 cans of Heineken. I fancy another 5. They can arrive in 9 minutes and someone could throw that on their back, pedal a bike and get it to me. I'll pay £5 to £10 for that, right? The delivery charges are, you know, ridiculous at the moment. Same with Deliveroo. You know, if you wanted your 2 tubs of Ben and Jerry's, which is £5-6 worth of product, that, you know, you'll pay £4 to get it. You know, so that is economically wise for any discerning consumer, that doesn't in any way stack up. So it's the preserve of people who are, you know, very time conscious and typically pretty wealthy are willing just to pay those sorts of fees. Now that will get better. The key is, and the challenge is that you've got to assume that gets better, faster, more easy because of technological advancement. And that's the risk, right? That we're sitting there writing it off today. And there are all sorts of challenges. You know, a classic one is if someone's pedaling a road bike, I want 24 Heinekens and I want 6 loaves of bread, and, you know, how's someone going to get that on their back?
Yeah.
This is fairly niche at the moment in terms of that.
You mentioned a few things there. One of the things you talked about, cities, and it does seem to be a very city specific thing, because the model and manage to get these things out to people is you need that high density. Is that always going to be the case? Can you see a situation where they could expand into suburban areas, into towns, villages? And if so, is that where convenience, the existing convenience, needs to play a more active role in almost becoming that dark space in and of itself?
Yeah, so the interesting thing, right, is that, you know, why is this interesting for the convenience owner today? Is that, you know, these guys fundamentally need real estate. And if there's six of these running around in London, a bit like the coffee shops 15 years ago, and they all want the same site, you get property inflation pretty quickly. The economics don't stack up. There's an availability of site problem, which is why, you know, you get that and the marketing drives the sort of consolidation of the space. So I think one of the reasons, you know, Justin King, as an example of Sainsbury fame, backed the sort of snappy shopper app is that, you know, there's an obvious read across, which is, well, the convenience association and their members already have that real estate, already pretty well placed in densely populated neighborhoods. And it's all about the population density. And the economics are just a function of supply and demand in that particular market, you know, so they'll reflect the fact that there's only 3,000 people in an area, not 3 million people, as an example, and those economics will change. So could they come into those rural areas? Absolutely. But at the same point, they're still going to need a dark store. So partnering with the Deliveroos, with the Snappy Shopper, with the other things, is a real opportunity for the convenience sector to sort of at least head some of that risk off. I don't know if they'll mitigate it entirely, but head some of that off and really think about how you strategically partner with these guys to test and learn. And the key is just to focus, as always, on what you're really good at rather than try and replicate someone else. You know, you remember when Tesco tried to build their own tablet and become a tech company for at least 6 months, right? And trying to compete with Apple. Completely futile experience, because then they're not built that way. They're the best, you know, one of the best grocers in the world, right? But they're not a tech company. So I think the key for your members is to say, right, what are we really good at, and how do we partner with people who could complement that?
Yeah, and well, on the bigger scale, Google attempting to be a social media company, it's just just not working.
No, I think, you know, no matter how bright you are, you have your core competencies. I think you stick to them, and there are, you know, the interesting thing about software is when you look at software, it does, you know, the biggest risk for retail is not, you know, M&S's biggest risk isn't John Lewis. M&S's biggest risk is Instagram developing social commerce. So there are various different aspects that you've got to be careful of. But I think for the core grocers who are used to grocery, supply chains, logistics, merchandising, you know, really strong pricing, great consumer relationships, I think it's sort of how do I outsource to the best people to partner with that could protect my business? I think they need to be alive to that.
Yeah. And then another thing you mentioned was the example of someone going out on a road bike and delivering these things. Interestingly enough, I saw that one of the investors in, I think, Getir is Peloton, which brings in my idea of if somehow you could, instead of getting people to buy a Peloton, you could give them points instead of money to ride a bike and deliver stuff to people and have that be a sort of fitness program. I think sort of solve a lot of the cost problems, but it's probably some issues around that.
I think the challenge is the Peloton bike is 2,500. So if you're looking for a high-end demographic to then become delivery drivers, I think you might struggle to entice them in if they've just spent a fortune on a Peloton bike. But I take your point. Look, I think there are, you know, there's some really interesting stuff in this fusion between digital and physical. You know, the tokenization that's starting to happen, some of the loyalty programs that are being built. You know, you look at what Nestle is and Rakuten are doing in Asia with this tokenization technology called Wabi, which is WAIBI, I think, from memory. And, you know, it's amazing how those programs are fusing the digital and the physical. And I think you'll see a lot more of that in terms of that sort of cross-selling points and loyalty and how you build those economics. And I think what people have got to be careful of is that the stock response I always get to this stuff is, oh, it's not profitable, so it's never going to work. But the reason it's not profitable is it's not scaled. And, you know, they're betting quite rightly that technology will get better. But most importantly, it doesn't really matter, right? Because if someone like Amazon is willing to step in and fund Deliveroo, it doesn't matter what anyone thinks, because Amazon can raise money at zero. percent cost. And if they want to fund that for the next decade and they're happy for it to lose money, that is still an enormous threat, whether we believe the economics are right or not.
And so what about sustainability though? I mean, another point is you talked about the road bikes. There are mopeds going around. I think Getir uses this sort of moped. Are these all going to have to be either electric vehicles or human powered vehicles? Is that the only way they're going to be able to be sustainable in the long term?
It's a very good question. I think there's a slide I use occasionally which shows that sort of online delivery models, the economics of electric are helpful, but the autonomous delivery, i.e. robots delivering it to you, is the single biggest step change in the single trade economics. So I think electric vehicles are undoubtedly helpful. They're definitely more sustainable, more environmentally friendly. But I don't think they're the sort of step change. I think they're just an iteration. I think the step change in why these things might work is, you know, the sort of automated autonomous vehicles, robotic delivery mechanisms that will come. I fully believe that they'll come. So yes, in the short term, it would be helpful. You're already seeing it, you know, all the big grocers are developing their own electric fleet. And Ocado have, you know, a whole host of electric vans on order, and so do Amazon with their electric vehicles, lorries, etc. So that's all coming as part of industry. I would assume that's coming, you know, to a material extent in the next couple of years anyway. I think the step change is autonomous vehicles when you look at that.
And so you said about that coming the next couple of years. I guess final question is, a lot of your job is about looking into the crystal ball in an educated way. Models, if we look, say, 3 years, 5 years, 10 years down the line, at what point do you see there being a tipping point, I guess, where convenience stores are thinking, okay, I need to have a store for customers at the front, and I need to have a store for logistics at the back? Where do you think that's coming?
So look, I honestly think that's here already. In terms of how businesses should think about it. I think it would be remiss of me not to say that, because I think I'm already seeing it. You know, we're seeing micro warehouses come. We've backed a business in our innovation lab called Haboo, which looks after small independent traders, predominantly marketplace traders, logistics requirements. You know, very, very talented guys running a software platform fundamentally. That is absolutely here. And you know, look at Tesco putting their automated delivery, you know, robotics in their stores, not building big dark stores, right? They're putting them in their stores. Because I think the best distribution network, ironically, is the one that's, you know, most, has the closest proximity to customers. And you know, the supermarkets have been very good about building a supermarket chain out that is very close to its customers, right? I forget the stats, but most of them can boast that they're half an hour to 90 plus percent of the entire population, you know, some probably even closer than that. So the key is always to use the assets that you have. And for the, you know, the ACS guys, the reality is they've got proximity to customers. So I would be thinking about, you know, what are the SKUs I'm not selling? How do I carve up the space differently? And how do I use the excess space for delivery, logistics, on demand? And because I think it's going to be hugely significant, right? Because effectively what it's doing is replacing some of that trade. Now, I think it's the preserve of the wealthy because of the delivery fees, but there's the technological advancements that enable that to get more efficient, you know, tend to be fairly large in nature in terms of steps forward. So I would be thinking about it right here, right now.
Yeah, it's really interesting. And it brings back one of the things that we heard from 7-Eleven a few years ago about more than 1,000 square feet almost being a sort of a luxury, and that you don't have to have more than space to be able to trade really effectively. So I think be it really interesting when we see new stores being built or refits being done of 2,000 and 3,000 square foot stores, how they allocate that space.
Yeah.
Which is a case of, right, we've got to line the walls of product anymore.
Well, if you think about, you know, Amazon Go is having a, you know, pretty interesting first dart at it. you remove all of the need for cashiers, all of these things that are taking out big chunks of space and huge chunks of capex for retail. And that's only going to get better, right? That's sort of iteration one, and they're experimenting with it. They're not rolling it out aggressively, and they're having a look at how consumers behave. And, you know, like always, there's an adoption curve for tech, because consumers at the moment, most people can't see an Amazon Go store, you know, anywhere near their home. So that'll take time. But at the same point, what you've done is remove a huge amount of A, complexity, and B, you know, largely space that isn't generating sales from that convenience store. If that can be repurposed and used in a different way, you know, then it becomes pretty powerful, I suspect, economically.
It's interesting, isn't it, that sort of long-term conditioning. I remember many years ago having sent to me a pad to stick to the back of my phone, which was a contactless tag. And then before iPhones were NFC compatible. And now, looking back now, it's like, oh, of course, they're just conditioning you to be able to do that when that tech comes in. So yeah, really, really interesting.
I love the simple things, right, that people don't really think about, like the alarm clock example I gave. For years, you know, getting an alarm clock was this sort of, you know, how cool is it? What does it do? Does it play music as well? Mm-hmm. You know, can I wake up to music was a huge leap forward, I remember, you know, and now you look at it and I just got a phone sitting there and it does absolutely everything and many, many million times of other things. So that's what you've got to assume, you know, you've got to assume that that software advancement will continue. You know, and what I love at the moment when you look at technology is you haven't just got one big structural move. You know, you've got robotics, you've got quantum computing, where, you know, the step change in computational power is absolutely incredible. You've got 3D printing, you've got 5G, you've got all these things that are converging all at the same time. And the compounding impact of that, I think, is incredibly powerful. So I think you've got to, you know, for this audience, I think it's an interesting thing just to step back and say, okay, well, actually, how do I get ahead of that trend? And if it's me as an owner, not having to invest that capital is entirely helpful. And if the venture capital community are willing to fund that, then I would be using their money quite happily to work out how this fits with my business.
Yeah, it's a fantastic point to end on. Matt, you've been incredibly generous with your time. We are immensely grateful, and we will be looking out very closely as to where True Global goes next. And I'm sure there'll be some amateur investors listening, thinking maybe something to get into as well. So, really appreciate it. And
nice to see you.
Please,
thank you. Thanks for having me.
Have a chat with us some other time.
Take care, Chris. Thanks ever so much.
Thanks again to Matt. A really interesting conversation. Really, as I said during the chat, very generous with his time. If you want to find out more about what True Global does, it's true.global. All the businesses they're investing in, all the things that they're looking at are detailed there. And there's just one thing to leave you with for this episode of the podcast, and that's to promote our member portal. There are hours and hours of fantastic content there, from ACS Live presentations to inductions to the convenience sector, study tour routes from around the world. You name it, anything we've been doing over the last couple of years that's been online content, interactive content, you can find it there on demand on the portal. So just go to the ACS website, click on the big member portal button, and everything you need will be there. That's it for this episode of the podcast. We'd love to hear what you think. Leave us a review on your podcast app. Follow us on Twitter @localshoppod and @ACS_localshops.